Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business of Sports.
The business of sports can be intimidating or hard for a startup to break into.
We really appreciate when our owners are actually there, you know, with us through the journey.
Teams, ours especially, have been very intentional to diversify at all levels of the company.
I think we're in the golden years for the NFL and college football.
Our demographic reach has continued to expand.
This is going to be really unlocking the streaming platform for sports fans.
Sports valuations are rising. We'll see when they peak.
You don't have to be the best in your sport to make a whole ton of money.
Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports show where we explore the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Michael Barr.
I'm Scarlett Fu.
And I'm Damian Sassauer.
Coming up, we're talking March Madness and the art of bracketology. We speak with a professor of mathematics and computer science to help us build the perfect bracket.
In our models, we rather than saying a game is worth one game, we will upweight it, both with time, saying that as you move deeper in the season, closer to March Madness, it's more predictive of how you'll play. And then also, if you win on the road or on a neutral court. And in these models, it also means that you're beating high-quality teams at those times. That actually does a good job of finding teams that sometimes can be misseeded.
And a friend of the show is joining us, Bloomberg Originals chief correspondent Jason Kelly, stopping by to talk about the latest episode of The Deal.
It's a new show from Bloomberg Originals. He hosts alongside one Alex Rodriguez. And this week's guest is none other than Derek Jeter.
Ooh, all that and more is coming up. But first, the MLB kicked off this week in South Korea with arguably the sport's biggest star.
That would be Shohei Ohtani. His Los Angeles Dodgers were in Seoul this week for a special two-game series against the San Diego Padres. It was a glimpse at how the MLB might try leveraging Ohtani's star power on the global stage.
Bloomberg's Lucas Shaw has been keeping up with this, and he is here now. Lucas, my man, welcome to the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, first, I'm going to get the elephant out of the room, and if it is true, it is kind of a shame. Shohei Ohtani's best friend and interpreter apparently now has been fired by the Dodgers because he is accused of stealing money from Shohei Ohtani, several million dollars because of gambling debts. Can you expand more on that?
Yeah, look, I don't have a ton more to say than what has been publicly reported, other than this is just about the worst start to the season that you could imagine for the Dodgers, for Ohtani, for Major League Baseball. You know, his signing attracted so much attention for him and the sport, which was seen as this big positive. They were playing these games in Seoul, their first games in Korea, all part of baseball's plan to really build out its fan bases worldwide and in Asia. And instead of the conversation being about, you know, the Dodgers and Padres, two good teams playing and all the excitement and six different players from Japan and South Korea, the right before the second game, everything becomes about Ohtani. And there's really no way I can see this ending well, because there's one scenario where his interpreter and best friend has been stealing from him to place all these bets, which is just, you know, bad news. Or then there's the sort of the more conspiratorial among us who are convinced that, like, whether it's the interpreter is a fall guy, or there's a cover up, or there's something, and none of this is good. And I do find it a little bit, I don't know if ironic or weird is the right word, considering how much sports media has been shoving gambling down our throat. That it's gambling, that's what gets
hypocrites.
These guys in trouble, which,
I mean, we kind of always knew, or at least I had this feeling that there was going to be some big collision between the fevered interest in sports gambling and professional athletes. At some point, the two would collide. I just didn't expect it to be the biggest name in baseball at this point, at the start of the season. You wrote about Shohei Ohtani in a Bloomberg Business Week story. The thing about Ohtani is that he is pretty quiet. It's not like he goes around putting himself out there. He's really preferred to let his talent on the field speak for itself. At some point, he might need to address this issue with his best friend slash translator's gambling debts. What do we know about how willing he is to talk about himself and reveal himself to the public?
He's been very guarded since he got to the U.S. And really before then, he didn't do a lot of press. You know, probably the one story that stands out to everyone is he did grant access and spend some time with this reporter for a GQ cover story a couple of years ago. And he does do press after games, not every game. And there are more limitations around access to him in the locker room than others. You know, I went to spring training earlier this year and I got a press pass. And they said that when the locker room is open, that I could go up and talk to anyone except for Shohei, which I took as a sign. But he does scrums where you have, you know, 40 people around him asking questions. And he's going to do some press conferences. I don't know how they're going to respond to this, because compared to most athletes, he does not say as much. And he certainly divulges very little about himself, which is why it became big news a few weeks ago when he announced on Instagram that he had been married.
Yeah. And let's just mention as well that the translator, Mizuhara, is the one who helps translate his words when he does talk to press. So awkward.
Take it back, Lucas, to 1994, right? I mean, let's take it back to Hideo Nomo when he first joined Major League Baseball. I'm thinking Ichiro Suzuki, I'm thinking Hideki Matsui. These gentlemen were not out there in the press every day either, right? And maybe that has something to do, as you rightly point out in your Business Week article, just about baseball players in general and the fact that they're not basketball players and they're not involved in every play in the game. So it's hard. And there are 162 games, Lucas, right? So how much time do they really have to be out there socially, to be out there with the public, with the press? But my goodness, we don't want to be, you know, making, you know, comparisons to Pete Rose here. I mean, what is Shohei going to have to do to right the ship?
I think there's a difference in how baseball players interact with the press and other sports. There's also a difference in how Japanese players interact with the press than American players, right? There's an expectation on the U.S. side that, you know, you see at the end of a basketball game, like LeBron basically has to do press every single day, right? And so he just goes and he answers questions. And we also are just in a society where our biggest celebrities post a lot about themselves all over social media. Now, not everyone does, but it is sort of customary. And it's more a surprise if you don't do that. I think the relationship in Japan is a little bit different. There is a little more respect for the personal lives of some of these people, which is why that being said, the amount of attention on someone like Ohtani and the amount of press devoted to someone like Ohtani in the Japanese press is unlike anything, you know, we've seen with anyone here, right? Like the press in Japan treats everything that Ohtani does kind of like he's the president of the country. And so I can understand the reluctance to put yourself out there when you have a press that's that interested in you. I mean, in terms of righting the ship, I don't know. It's so early in this. It's hard. He's going to continue to play. It's going to be a huge distraction for the team. I imagine that Major League Baseball will have, and the Dodgers will have to weigh in at some point. But I assume at least in the short term, they're saying, you know, we're going to let the legal proceedings and all this play out, and they'll just pray that they don't have to take action.
Well, Michael Barr, let's put some numbers around this, yeah? I mean, Ohtani in December signed a 10-year, $700 million contract, most of it deferred, the largest contract by far in team sports. His jersey sold at double the pace of Leo Messi. Double the pace, just to give you a sense of what, you know, what we're talking about. And more importantly, ticket prices for Dodgers games are up, what, 10, 15% on the year. So, I mean, the dollars speak to the fact that, you know, there's no avoiding the press. I mean, Shohei Ohtani must confront the press here. What kind of message can he possibly deliver at the beginning of the season to get the fans comfortable with what's going on?
Oh, well, I was in Japan last December and you see his face everywhere. He's on the billboard. He's in so many different advertisements. He is the most famous person in the country. And then, yeah, I mean, at spring training, there were hundreds of people there. And even though he was new to the team, and this is a team that has Mookie Betts, who's one of the five best players in baseball, and Freddie Freeman, who's one of the 5 or 10 best players in baseball, at least every other jersey, if not 70% of the jerseys, were already Ohtani. And you had some of that was, you know, your average just diehard baseball fan. And some of it, there was a recognizable contingent where I'd say probably half the press and like 20 to 30% of the fans at spring training were Japanese and did not speak English.
On top of that, you've written about in that article for Bloomberg Business Week about the different sponsorship deals that not just Ohtani has signed, but the Dodgers have a lot of new advertisers because they know that they're being broadcast to a global audience in Japan, in South Korea, in Taiwan. And that extends to even teams that are playing the Dodgers. So it's not just the Dodgers that are reaping the spoils.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of money available to everyone around Ohtani, assuming that this kind of this latest news doesn't ruin it, is pretty unprecedented. You know, Stan Kasten, who's the runs the Dodgers day to day, told me that they were going to announce a whole new suite of sponsors before the season. I don't believe they've done that yet, but that's going to be, you know, folks who've bought signage at the stadium. There'll probably be some special food and beverage that's related to Japan. And there are also, you can buy these ads that if you watch the TV broadcast, they sort of show up behind the plate that gets digitally inserted. They sold out of that. And so that was where he said that he's heard from sponsors and from other teams that they were just buying into other teams' games, but only for the ones against the Dodgers, because you've got these Japanese companies that want anything affiliated with Shohei. So, you know, I talked to one person who projected the Dodgers might make as much as an extra $100 million this year. Some said that that was high, that it would be, but it would definitely be in the tens of millions of dollars. You know, that's one thing where a gambling scandal definitely doesn't help, but I assume most of that money is already committed.
You know, Scarlett, one thing Lucas points out in his Bloomberg Business Week article, which is, I mean, really great. And, you know, by the way, just for our audience, Lucas is a Dodger fan, just full disclosure. But, you know, what Lucas points out is, you know, all this hype about South Korea and Japan, yet most, a very significant portion of Major League Baseball players hail from Latin America, yet the focus, the center of the baseball universe today is certainly Asia. Lucas, I mean, it's a great point. I mean, talk to us a little bit about that. Like, why is that?
Why is it that the focus is Asia? Because there's just way more money there.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about Latin America. Yes, there are a lot of players from Dominican Republic, from Venezuela, from Curacao, from all over the region. Puerto Rico, part of the U.S., but they're not large media markets.
Right.
So there's only so much money to be made there. Most of the countries have fairly low GDP per capita. So it's not like you've got folks who are going to spend a ton of money on merchandise. You do have a lot of good players, and you do have local leagues. But even those leagues are sort of less commercialized than what you're seeing in Japan and South Korea, which are already the second and third biggest markets commercially for Major League Baseball. They have strong local leagues. They have a decent number of players. They have rabid fans with money to spend. And so I think they see a lot of opportunity there. They see some opportunity in Europe. And they're just going to try to gradually build out the following for Major League Baseball around the world.
Bloomberg's Lucas Shaw. You can read his latest piece, Superstar Shohei Ohtani Will Transform Baseball, if he wants to, now at Bloomberg.com. Plus, be on the lookout for it in the upcoming edition of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. Thank you so much, Lucas, for joining us. Up next, we take a look at the latest episode of The Deal with Alex Rodriguez and Jason Kelly, a new show from Bloomberg Originals. You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports show, where we explore the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Michael Barr, along with Scarlett Fu and Damian Sassauer. The Deal with Alex Rodriguez and Jason Kelly is a new series from Bloomberg Originals, and the latest episode features none other than New York Yankees legend Derek Jeter. Alex, Jason, and Derek cover a lot of ground from team ownership, investing, and even Derek's relationship with A-Rod. Take a listen.
People need to put it to bed, I think, at some point. I mean, this was 20-something year. I've known him for 30 years, you know what I mean? And I get asked more about our relationship than I do my wife. You know what I'm saying?
It's just, Derek.
It doesn't. Yeah, I mean, it's just put it to bed. I mean, we said we're fine. We're working together again. You know, you can't change history. History happened, right? It's over and done with. You move on.
What's funny, our partners, you know, Hannah and Jack, I think they're happy that we're in this place. I've had so many New York Yankee fans come up and say, I'm so glad that you guys, I don't care if you're best friends, I'm just glad that you guys are working together.
Yeah.
And when they have their hero and someone that they admire together, that won together, I think if it's warming to their heart to know that we are getting along.
Yeah.
That's my thought.
Here to tell us more about the latest episode of The Deal featuring Derek Jeter is co-host and old friend of the show, Bloomberg Originals chief correspondent, Jason Kelly. Hello, Jason. Welcome back.
I just wander in every now and again.
Jason, man, this show is just off like a rocket.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we're having a lot of fun with it. Reception has been good so far, but especially excited about this week's edition.
Yeah, because, you know, now with the baseball season officially underway because they played in South Korea, A-Rod's old teammate, number two, Derek Jeter.
The captain to you and me.
The captain, yes.
Number two.
And he laid down some knowledge, Jason, about what he thinks about when he goes through investing and his own personal thoughts.
I invest in people. Mm. You know, you run into people all the time that have great ideas. Everyone has a great idea. Sure. Everyone has a business going to be a $1 billion business. But you have to invest in people and you have to get to know them and you have to know if they're passionate about what they're doing. Some people have businesses where they're in it to make money. Look, we all want to make money. But if that's your number one priority, if you're not passionate about it, then I think that's a red flag.
These guys, you talk about being smart with their money, Jason. They're out of the park. Forgive the pun.
Well, and Jeter is, you know, for Yankee fans and even for folks beyond Yankee world, I mean, certainly one of one in terms of where he sits and kind of the firmament. You think about all the famous Yankees who have gone through the Bronx over the years, and he certainly is on that list. And I have to say, you know, I'd spent a little bit of time with him, not as much time as we spent for The Deal, and he's just a fascinating character.
A fascinating character who, to be honest, New Yorkers don't know that well. We know of him, but he always played his cards really close to the vest. Is that the right metaphor? He just, you know, didn't open himself up that much, and that helped him survive all those years in New York. What did you notice about him? What did you observe about him?
Well, it's interesting you say that because we took that issue, you know, sort of head on because he did manage to be utterly drama free for the most part.
Well said.
It's certainly drama of his own making. And one of the things he said was he realized, you know, being under the hot lights and all the expectation and attention of New York, that as long as he essentially answered the question once and then didn't answer it again, that was a winning playbook for people basically leaving him alone. And, you know, meanwhile, he had other people, including my co-host during his time, who were talking maybe more, mm-hmm. shall we say, to the media. And, you know, Derek just managed to, you know, sort of walk that line. He played his whole career, 20 years with the Yankees, 5 World Series. So he proved them all right.
He figured out a formula.
I am a huge Derek Jeter fan. I'm a huge A-Rod fan. But their relationship wasn't always so simple. You know, what did you notice about their interaction between one another?
So, I mean, it is the question, right? I mean, this is a relationship that played out very publicly. I would say the thing that I noticed is there's a lot of history there. You know, these are two guys, and you'll hear it and see it in this episode, who've known each other longer than they haven't. And, you know, they met when I believe Alex was 17, Derek was 19. And, you know, they were the hottest shortstops. They were both playing shortstop. They were generational talents. They were friends. They would, you know, stay at each other's houses.
Nomar was part of that crew, too, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that generate, you know, for baseball fans among us, you think back to those shorts. I mean, it was just it was an embarrassment of riches for the league. And actually, before we filmed the episode, I actually showed Alex. This is in the video version of the deal. That cover of Sports Illustrated that they shared in 1997. So obviously their relationship got complicated when Alex came to New York. Alex said some things that he has since apologized for. What I saw was two guys who they've sort of grown up and they, I think, appreciate each other. They appreciate what they were able to do together. And we talk about this notion that when you look at great deals that have happened in baseball, getting Alex Rodriguez to the Yankees, and by the way, shifting him to third base, let's not overlook the fact that, you know, this was one of the most talented shortstops to ever play the game and moved to third, played right there, you know, a few feet from Derek Jeter, and they won the 09 World Series. Yep. By the way, the last time the Yankees won the World Series was that team. And so it's a relationship that has certainly matured. They're working together on Fox now. I mean, Derek has a great line in the show when I asked them directly about it. And he says, man, I get asked more about my relationship with him than I do my wife.
You know, I got to ask you, Jason, you know, one of the things that from the interview, obviously, that Derek Jeter says is he invests in people.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember an interview after he left the game and he was asked, what do you miss most about the game? And for me, it stuck with me because he said, you know, what I really miss are the people, the locker room, you know? And one person that he mentioned was Hideki Matsui, who, if you remember the Yankees, he, translator, he didn't speak English very well, but what a champion, what a great New York Yankee. In fact, by the way, his locker, Tamarack Country Club, is right next to mine. And, you know, the question I have about, you know, what Derek Jeter looks for in people. I mean, for someone like a Hideki Matsui to pop into his head when that question's asked, what's your take? Like, what kind of person is he looking to invest in?
You know, I think he is looking for people who are, you know, people of integrity, you know, sort of all the obvious things. But one of the things that comes across so clearly in all of these episodes, especially when we're talking to former athletes, is this, you know, the discipline, the commitment to hard work, the coachability, being on a team, knowing how to win and lose. And I think, you know, part of what Derek and Alex appreciate is the cliche is true. If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. Yeah. And if you're playing for the New York Yankees, you are playing in a place, at a level, in a milieu, not just in Yankee Stadium, but beyond, that the lights are a little bit brighter, the sounds are a little bit louder. And so if you can do it in that environment, then you've proven something.
So we know that A-Rod has been, you know, he's been photographed talking with and investing with Warren Buffett, or certainly learning from Warren Buffett. What about Derek Jeter's path to entrepreneurship and investment?
Yeah, I mean, his has been a little bit different in the sense that, you know, he jumped more or less right into baseball management and ownership with the Miami Marlins. Ultimately, he left there after just a couple years. You know, he's talked about sort of strategic differences he had with the ownership of that club. He is not, I think, eager to return to that sort of job, you know, whether ownership in some other form or fashion comes his way. Hard to say. Mm-hmm. You know, he has invested in a collectibles company. He's, you know, done a lot of endorsements. I think he's really, I got the sense that he's sort of taking a beat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, trying to figure out what he wants to do and what he wants to be, has young kids. You know, these guys, they
put their lives on hold.
They do. I mean, listen, they are well paid. They are well compensated and, you know, and adored and all these different things. But in the very basics of life, you know, that we've all been able to take advantage of, they're a little bit delayed in being able to do that. And so I think I think he is enjoying that right now. I think he also, you know, we actually taped this in Los Angeles last fall when Alex and Derek and Big Poppy and Kevin Burkhart were doing their playoff baseball deal. And I think he likes that. You know, I think he likes being back in the mix and being able to talk about baseball from a step removed.
So you got two rich handsome guys, which is six.
Three, Michael.
I would say three.
Three, yes, that's right.
I would say three.
You got Jason in there. I'm sorry, man. You're running wingman for everybody. And, you know, it's which brings us to the point now. It's just a heck of a bad segue. Bloomberg's annual brackets for
college. Okay. Other rich guys. Okay,
yes,
sure.
Other rich guys in this. Let's talk about that.
Sure.
You guys talk about that in the show, do you?
We don't talk about it in the show, but we. But this is a project that I've been working on. This is the eighth year that I've been doing it here, 9 years total that we've been doing this here at Bloomberg. It's an annual tradition where we go to titans of Wall Street, corporate America, and the sports world. We have, I think we're going to end up with close to 55 participants. They each pledge $20,000. They pick a charity and they fill out brackets for both the women's and the men's tournament. And the top three on each side get to split the money among their charities. So Steve Pagliuca, actually owner of the Boston Celtics, is the defending champion on the men's side. So he's looking to repeat. And it's super, super fun. You know, Peter Grauer, our chairman, is a huge devotee of this. He participates. He's a big UNC Tar Heel guy. He has not won. He placed 1 year.
Okay.
Mike Bloomberg plays. He has also never won. it's a huge amount of fun, and it is a very fun time for me every year because I get to see, you know, these people that we are all write about on a near daily basis. Talking a little trash.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, they're a little competitive with each other. So it's a lot of fun.
And you get to see their brackets before you fill yours out.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. So I got
Isn't that called insider trading?
I don't know. I mean, you guys, I think, are going to talk to an expert about this. I mean, filling out brackets. Yeah. I mean, bracketology is a science.
Or an art, or luck.
I don't know. Or something.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Originals chief correspondent Jason Kelly. Don't miss the latest episode of The Deal with Alex Rodriguez and Jason Kelly. Catch it on Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Television. Stream it on Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Originals. And of course, listen on demand anytime on your favorite podcast platform. Up next, we dive into bracketology with March Madness getting underway. You're listening to the Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports show, where we explore the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Michael Barr, along with Scarlett Fu and Damian Sassauer. Oh, man, if there was any part of this show, and we've got a lot of great parts of this show, that I have my pen and pencil and paper ready, because I'm working on my brackets and crossing my fingers. Tim Chartier, he is the Joseph R. Morton Professor of Mathematics and Computer Science at Davidson College. And what's even more important is that my man is going to help me in bracketology. Tim, thank you, sir, for joining us on the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
Oh, thank you, and thanks for bringing a pencil.
Yeah. I'm going to be chewing it, man, through the whole tournament. What is it? This is a real general question, but what's that one big secret when you're filling out a bracket that you need to know?
Well, I would say there are two things. One of them involves math, and one of them does, but kind of doesn't. One of them is that you have to move away from, unless you're just doing it for fun, you have to move away from your personal preferences with colleges, because it can really make you make some choices that if you only look at the data won't hold. And that's very true for me teaching in North Carolina, where people could have some pretty strong opinions about different shades of blue.
No, not in North Carolina.
The other one that comes into it is actually that factors like strength of schedule, where that's in the ability to play at home versus away and who you beat in that strength of schedule, tends to be at least predictive to an extent. There's a lot of randomness in March Madness, which is just inherently difficult to predict.
How much research do people do into each matchup? Or is this something where for a newbie or someone who doesn't follow college basketball, you have a number 3 seed versus a number 15 seed? You're going to pick the number 3 seed because, of course, it makes more sense.
Yeah, one of the things that you can actually do if you're a newbie is just kind of look for the tendencies of which seeds tend to beat other seeds. Like, we tend to have number 1, number 2, and number 3 seeds that get all the way to the finals. That can kind of help people who aren't following the sport as much. I actually have a website, marchmathness.davidson.edu, where people make very simple choices. And I actually work with middle school kids so that they can use math to make their choices. And behind it is that strength of schedule type thing. So either way, people can play with that. But it's also, you're not going to get a perfect bracket just because it's so incredibly improbable. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's fun just to just give a shot in the dark and go with the team anyway. But there are, like, the 5-12 is a common one that we expect to happen.
Tim, you received the Alfred P. Sloan Research Fellowship for Research in Mathematics. You're the vice president for the Mathematical Association of America. I really just have one question for you. Are you banned from any casinos in Las Vegas or Atlantic City at this point? And are you allowed to place bets on FanDuel or DraftKings?
Well, I actually do not do any sports betting, and that's because I work on the other side. I do weekly consulting for the NBA league office on game integrity in the context of sports betting. So I do not bet.
Well, Tim, I'm just kidding. But you mentioned strength of schedule, and you know that takes me to my next question, and it's an important one here. Look at the Big East. Look at the teams that were omitted from the Big East, and then look at the Mountain West, and look at the low seeds coming out of the Mountain West, although they got a lot more teams in the tournament. How do your models establish strength of schedule when there seems to be such confusion across the NCAA?
Yeah, and that's a really important point, is that the fact that there are so few games being played between conferences, that's what can trick the strength of schedule methods. It's one of the things that we struggle with as researchers. It's also why we like looking at March Madness, is because it's such a great example of not a lot of data. Even though it's 5,000 games, it's 350 teams. It's not that much data. So it is a tricky part that even though we have fairly good models that will come out with predictions, at the same time, afterwards, we can sometimes look more carefully at the data and see why, like, one game between two conferences might be all we're relying on, or just a couple games, and that they were so close that winning models or the scoring percentage models don't really pan out for us.
Tim, you're a very noble man, because in your position, you don't bet on sports. I do. And I remember last year, Fairleigh Dickinson just shattered brackets all to hell.
Shattered.
I mean, boom. It just, oh my goodness. The odds of a perfect bracket, which has never happened, it's 1 in 2.3 billion. I mean, that's why we talk about it when someone picks, you know, is perfect through the Sweet 16. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about more about a perfect bracket?
Sure. So the 2.3 billion statistic is coming from that people are, it's assuming that people are 71% correct on average within the tournament. So that's where that's coming from in terms of that. Sometimes even that is a difficult number to kind of get in your head in terms of how big is that. That's like me picking one given second in 74 years, and you have to pick which second I chose. And that's why it's so difficult to do. If you're flipping a coin,
Like, you just have no idea what's going on. The odds go to 50-50, and suddenly you have one in nine quintillion. That's like me picking 1 second in almost 300 billion years. And so that's why we don't see it, because you can't just reduce the what we call the sample space. You can't reduce it much because the upsets are going to happen and you really don't know where. And so it's a fun problem. It creates the madness, and it's why we all have a lot to talk about in the coming weeks.
One thing that I'm fascinated by is that you teach March Madness in your classes. You have a math modeling class where you learn ranking methods that can produce brackets. There's an independent study part of the course that studies data analytics in the context of madness. Has enrollment in your classes and interest in this part of your curriculum shot up with sports betting and the overall like numerology of sports in the past 10 years?
Yes, it has. But part of it actually, some of it can be in the context of sports betting, mm-hmm. but a lot of it actually has to do with wanting to work in data analytics or specifically sports analytics.
Oh, interesting.
Some of the students that I've worked with, one works for the Bulls, one worked for the Jets, one works for FanDuel, and so forth and so on. And others have gone to Amazon and Microsoft and firms like that.
They come in having read Moneyball and thinking, this is what I want to do.
Yeah. Yes, and the group that I created started with three students and grew to be 100, where they are actually supplying analytics to support the college coaches at Davidson College to get ready for games.
There's never been a perfect bracket. Has there ever been a perfect a bracket that's completely imperfect where no one got
any? That's a good question.
Of the picks, right?
Yeah, no, that's equally difficult. Mm-hmm. Both are very, very difficult. When I give talks, I'll point out that either getting in the 99th percentile, beating 99% of brackets in one of these massive online pools, or being under 1%. Is also very, very difficult. You can sometimes create it where you just make nonsense type predictions, but even then, it's very difficult. One time, my son created one that was under the 1 percentile, and I asked him, how did you create your bracket? And he said, I did coin flipping. And I said, well, normally coin flipping is like 3 or 4%. Like, I've actually tested that. And I said, who did you have winning the tournament? And he said, Davidson College. And I was like, you had Davidson winning, which is where I teach, winning the tournament? He said, yes, every time Davidson played, I flipped the coin until they won.
Nice.
Tim, talk to us a little bit about how your models incorporate where the games are being played. We all know about the home court advantage, right? And I know that's really important when you're talking about basketball. I mean, are your models, running before Selection Sunday, or do they just kick in right afterwards? They find out where these teams are playing, and does that have a very big or small impact on what you're picking here?
It has a big impact. We upweight. So the way that it works is that in our models, we rather than saying a game is worth one game, we will upweight it, both with time, saying that as you move deeper in the season, closer to March Madness, it's more predictive of how you'll play. And then also, if you win on the road or on a neutral court, a neutral court is something like March Madness, where neither of them are playing at home, mm-hmm. and the various mini tournaments they play during the tournament. Generally, when you upweight away and the neutral court later in the season, and in these models, it also means that you're beating high-quality teams at those times. That actually does a good job of finding teams that sometimes can be misseeded.
A lot to think about there. I want to continue on something you had mentioned earlier, which is a lot of your students have moved on to be the analytics guys for the Bulls, for instance. What is the placement record for your students? Do they have to go on to get a master's degree? I mean, is there a real thirst for data analytic talent out of universities for these franchises?
Yes, there is. And one of the tricks is that if you come out into a professional sports organization, you're expected to know what you're doing and support immediately. Those that go on either into industry or on to a master's degree kind of get more training and then can move into professional sports. But all the ones that I mentioned went directly out of our program and in. And even this semester, we're working with a NASCAR team, we're working with a Major League Baseball team, and then this one group is helping me with March Madness. So they get a lot of hands-on experience at the college level, which helps them in the market.
Tim, last question I have for you, and really is what's your vibe from these students that you're teaching here is, you know, behavioral, you know, like,
oh, good question.
You know, talk to us about, like, they come in with their preconceived notions, the teams that they like, you know, where they're from, you know, the things that they look for, you know, and then, you know, they've got to throw it all out the door, right? And let the numbers speak for themselves. Talk to us a little bit about the focus that these students of yours have on the math and how can they break out of their behavioral biases? And do you see, a lot of students having difficulty doing that?
Yeah, and one of the reasons I do March Madness is precisely for that reason, is that students, well, even if they don't follow sports, not all the students in the class follow sports. Like mentioned earlier, maybe you have a friend that went to Colgate, mm-hmm. and you have some other reason that you actually like a school. And so actually, in the coming weeks, I will actually start class, but I will wait a little bit because the students have their brackets and they talk to each other about why things went wrong. You know, I had the initial model and Duke was doing better than I wanted them to, so I changed my numbers and changed my model, and they begin to talk about the decisions that they made. So in a way, March Madness makes the point without me needing to make the point. And when I make the point in about a month, everyone has context to understand what I'm saying.
You just let it be revealed.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yep.
Our thanks to Tim Chartier, Davison College Professor of Mathematics and Computer Science, for joining us to talk through the art of bracketology. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Business of Sports. We're here each and every week at the same time. For my colleagues Scarlett Fu and Damian Sassauer, I'm Michael Barr. Tune in again next week for the latest on the stories moving big old money in the world of sports. You're listening to the Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.